A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about genealogy, specifically the family buff everyone seems to have, the one who pores over old records and disappears into archives. The core question is pretty straightforward. For the average determined genealogist tracing European ancestry, how many generations back can they realistically get? And then the bigger question. Are there people who can trace their lineage demonstrably, with actual documentation, all the way to the ancient world, or even before it?
Oh, this is a great question, and the answer splits into two very different stories, what's typical and what's exceptional. Let's start with the typical, because it's humbling in its own way. For most European genealogy, the brick wall hits somewhere between the late 1500s and the early 1700s. Call it roughly 10 to 14 generations.
That's it? 10 generations feels like, what? Your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. I lose count after 4.
About 300 years, give or take. And the reason is painfully concrete. Before the Council of Trent in 1563, most European parishes weren't required to keep baptismal, marriage, and burial registers. Even after that mandate, compliance was spotty for decades, so you're dependent on church records, and those records simply don't exist before a certain point.
The bottleneck isn't DNA, or memory, or family lore. It's whether a priest in some village in Saxony bothered to write things down in a book that didn't get burned, flooded, or eaten by mice.
Mice, fire, war, mold, bad handwriting, and priests who just didn't care. The 30 Years' War alone, from 1618 to 1648, destroyed an enormous number of parish registers across Central Europe. Whole communities vanished from the documentary record, and even when records survive, you hit another wall, literacy. Before the 1800s, most people couldn't sign their own names. You're trying to trace people who left almost no paper trail of their own existence beyond a baptismal entry that says Johann, son of Johann.
Son of Johann. That's the whole biography. Name, paternity, date, and the priest's terrible Latin.
That's the good case. But here's where the geography gets interesting. And this connects directly to the prompts mention of European migrations. The brick wall date varies enormously by region. In England, parish records start as early as 1538 because Thomas Cromwell, of all people, mandated them. So English genealogists can sometimes push back to the early 1500s, maybe the late 1400s if they're lucky with manorial court rolls. In Scandinavia, Swedish church records are remarkably complete from the 1680s onward, and the Lutheran church was meticulous. But in Ireland?
Oh, the Irish record situation is famously catastrophic.
The Four Courts Fire of 1922 destroyed the Public Record Office, which held virtually all Irish census returns from the 1800s, plus most Church of Ireland parish registers going back centuries. For Irish genealogy, getting back to 1800 is considered a significant achievement. Before 1780, you're in miracle territory.
We've got a range. Best case, maybe 15 or 16 generations in parts of England or Sweden. Worst case, you're stuck at 5 or 6 in places where records were systematically destroyed. The average determined genealogist is probably hitting a wall around 12 generations in, staring at a church record that's the last surviving document naming their ancestor, and behind that, darkness.
That darkness is what makes the second part of the question so fascinating, because you asked if anyone can trace their lineage demonstrably to the ancient world, and the answer is yes, but it's not what most people imagine.
All right, I'm braced. Tell me about the exceptions.
Let's start with the biggest one, the Confucius family tree. It's recognized by the Guinness World Records as the largest extant family tree. It spans over 2,500 years, going back to Confucius himself, who was born in 551 BC. The current edition, published in 2009, includes over 2 million descendants across 83 generations.
2 million living descendants documented in one tree. That's not genealogy, that's a demographic survey.
The documentation is astonishingly rigorous. The genealogy has been continuously maintained since at least the Han Dynasty, with periodic updates commissioned by imperial decree. The Ming and Qing dynasties both sponsored official revisions. The Kong family, Kong is Confucius's surname, maintained a family registry with verification procedures, expulsion clauses for false claims, and a genealogical committee that adjudicated disputes.
This is an oral tradition or legend. This is a bureaucratic institution maintaining a 2.5 millennium paper trail.
With DNA confirmation in recent years. In 2009, genetic testing confirmed the Y chromosome haplotype of self-identified Kong descendants matched across branches consistent with a single common ancestor in the expected time frame. That's not proof of Confucius specifically. You'd need his DNA for that, but it's proof of a single male progenitor roughly when he lived.
That's the gold standard. What else qualifies?
The Japanese imperial family. The traditional account traces the imperial line back to Emperor Jimmu in 660 BC, but the historically verifiable portion starts much later. The earliest emperor with solid documentary and archaeological corroboration is Emperor Kinmei, who reigned from 539 to 571 AD. That's still about 1,500 years of continuous documented lineage. The Imperial Household Agency maintains records that are considered reliable from roughly the 6th century onward.
15 centuries is nothing to sneeze at, but the claim of going back to 660 BC, that's the mythological part.
Right, and that's the pattern you see everywhere. Royal and noble genealogies often claim descent from gods, legendary heroes, or figures from classical antiquity, but the documentary chain breaks long before those claims. The Anglo-Saxon kings claim descent from Woden. The Merovingians claim descent from a sea monster.
A sea monster?
A Kinator, specifically. Half bull, half fish.
I'm going to guess the parish records for that are a little thin.
The point is, even among elites, verifiable genealogy hits a hard stop somewhere in the early medieval period. The Merovingian dynasty itself is historically attested from the mid-5th century, but connecting them to any earlier figure is pure legend. The oldest verifiable European genealogy that isn't royal is probably the Massimo family of Rome, who can document their lineage to the late 10th century. That's about 1,000 years, roughly 30 generations.
1,000 years is the practical ceiling for European commoner genealogy, and even that requires your ancestors to have been unusually prominent and well documented. For the average person, 300 to 500 years is the realistic limit, and that's if you're lucky with records.
Here's what I think is the most interesting part, the thing that most coverage of genealogy misses. The brick wall isn't just about missing documents. It's about the nature of identity and record-keeping changing over time. Before the late Middle Ages, most people didn't have fixed surnames. In much of Europe, surnames were still stabilizing in the 14 and 1500s. So when you're trying to trace your patrilineal line back before surnames, you're essentially trying to follow a thread that the people themselves didn't think of as a thread.
The concept of family lineage as something a peasant would track is itself anachronistic. Your medieval ancestor, Johann, son of Johann, he probably didn't know his great-grandfather's name. He had no reason to.
He might not have even conceptualized family the way we do. Kinship was often reckoned bilaterally. Both sides mattered, and the patrilineal obsession is partly a product of inheritance law, primogeniture, and later Victorian genealogical societies.
The genealogist hitting a brick wall in 1650 isn't just running out of paper. They're running into a cultural boundary where the very idea of a traceable bloodline dissolves.
Which brings us to the hardest question hidden in the prompt. What does demonstrably and accurately mean when you go far enough back? Because there's a mathematical reality lurking here that's deeply uncomfortable for genealogy enthusiasts.
I know where you're going with this.
You have 2 parents, 4 grandparents, 8 great-grandparents. The number doubles every generation. Go back 30 generations, roughly 1,000 years, and you have over 1 billion slots in your family tree.
Which is more people than were alive on Earth 1,000 years ago.
By a lot. The global population around the year 1000 was about 300 million. Europe's population was maybe 40 million. Your theoretical number of ancestors vastly exceeds the actual number of people who existed. Which means the same individuals appear in your family tree over and over and over again through different lines.
Everyone is their own cousin, repeatedly.
And the further back you go, the more this compounds. At some point, essentially every person in a given region who left descendants is the ancestor of everyone else from that region who left descendants. Geneticists call this the identical ancestors point. For Europe, it's estimated that the most recent common ancestor of all Europeans lived roughly 1,000 years ago, and the identical ancestors point, the time when everyone alive then who has any living descendants is an ancestor of all living Europeans, is only about 2,000 years ago.
If you're of European descent, and you could actually trace your tree back 2,000 years, which you can't, because records don't exist, you'd find that you're descended from literally every person in Europe at that time who has any living line at all. Julius Caesar, if he has living descendants, is your ancestor. But so was the guy who cleaned his stables.
Provided they both left surviving lines. And that's the thing, most lines die out. But mathematically, if you go back far enough, you're either descended from everyone who left descendants or from no one. There's no middle ground.
This is the thing that genealogy buffs don't always want to hear. The meticulous work of tracing your specific lineage through parish records, it's real, it's valuable, it connects you to actual named individuals. But it's also a tiny, tiny sample of the vast web of ancestors who actually contributed to your genome.
Most of those ancestors are completely, irretrievably lost to history. They left no records, no names, no trace except the DNA you carry. Genealogy is the art of rescuing a few dozen or a few hundred names from that ocean of anonymity.
Which is why the exceptions are so striking. The Confucius tree, the Japanese imperial line. These are the rare cases where institutional continuity preserved what would otherwise have dissolved.
There's one more exception worth mentioning because it's different in kind from the others. The Cohen line.
The Jewish priestly caste.
Genetic studies in the late 1990s found that a high proportion of Jewish men who identify as Kohanim, the priestly descendants of Aaron, share a specific Y chromosome haplotype. This marker and its variations are found in both Ashkenazi and Sephardic populations, suggesting a common ancestor who lived roughly 3,000 years ago, which is consistent with the traditional dating of Aaron.
That's not a documented paper genealogy. It's a genetic signature that's been passed down through an unbroken male line for maybe 100 generations, preserved by endogamy and tradition.
It's not a family tree with names and dates, but it is a demonstrable lineage in the genetic sense, a continuous chain of fathers and sons stretching back to the Iron Age. And it's one of the few cases where molecular evidence aligns with an ancient textual tradition.
That raises a question I've been turning over. When the prompt asks about tracing lineage demonstrably and accurately to the ancient world, are we privileging documentary evidence over genetic evidence? Because the documentary record is inherently biased toward elites, toward literate societies, toward cultures that kept archives. DNA doesn't care about any of that.
That's the tension. Documentary genealogy is compelling because it gives you names, dates, places, a story, but it's also fragile, fragmentary, and class-biased. Genetic genealogy is more democratic. Everyone's DNA tells a story, but it can't give you names. It can tell you that your patrilineal ancestor lived in what's now Bavaria 3,000 years ago, but it can't tell you his name was Gunther and he was a blacksmith.
The name is what people want. Genealogy is ultimately about identity, not just biology. Finding out you share a Y chromosome with some Bronze Age farmer in the Danube Valley is scientifically interesting, but it doesn't give you the same emotional connection as finding a parish register with your great-great-grand-grandfather's name and occupation.
That emotional connection is what drives people through the brick walls. I've read accounts of genealogists spending years trying to break through a single generation, traveling to remote archives, learning to read 16th century handwriting, cross-referencing tax records and wills and land deeds. The level of detective work is extraordinary.
What's the hardest European brick wall to break through? You mentioned Ireland.
Ireland is brutal, but there are specific regional nightmares. Much of what's now Poland, Ukraine, and Belarus, the old Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, saw massive record destruction during the wars of the 20th century. The deluge in the 1650s destroyed a lot of earlier material, too. Jewish genealogy in Eastern Europe is legendarily difficult because of the Holocaust, but also because many Jewish communities in the Russian Empire were only required to adopt fixed surnames in the early 1800s. Before that, you're tracking patronymics through records that may or may not exist, and may or may not be in a language you can read.
If your ancestors were Eastern European Jews, getting back to 1800 is a major achievement, and before 1750 is often impossible.
Some communities kept remarkably good records. The Jewish community of Prague has burial records going back to the 15th century. But for most Ashkenazi genealogy, the brick wall is around 1800, sometimes earlier. That's only 6 or 7 generations.
Compare that to what we said about Sweden, where you might get 16 generations. The inequality of documentary survival is staggering.
It's entirely a function of historical accident. War, fire, climate, institutional stability, literacy rates, the value of culture placed on written records. None of it reflects anything about the people themselves. Your Swedish ancestors weren't more important than your Polish ancestors. They just lived somewhere that kept better files.
Like having your life's work preserved because your village clerk was unusually diligent, versus lost forever because a soldier in some forgotten campaign decided to use the church registry as kindling.
The kindling thing is not hypothetical, by the way. There are documented cases of soldiers deliberately destroying archives during the Napoleonic Wars, the Thirty Years' War, the Russian Civil War. Sometimes records were burned for heat. Sometimes they were looted for the value of the parchment or the bindings. Sometimes they were just thrown into rivers.
The casualness of it is what gets me. Millennia of human existence, reduced to whatever happened to survive the attention span of a bored soldier in 1632.
Which is why I think there's something almost noble about the genealogical enterprise. It's an attempt to push back against entropy. To say this person existed, their life mattered, and we're not going to let them disappear.
Even if what survives is just a name, a date, and maybe an occupation. Johann, son of Johann, baptized March 12, 1641. That's the whole memorial. But it's something.
It's something. And for a lot of people, it's enough to feel a connection across centuries.
Let me ask you about a specific scenario from the prompt. If your ancestors moved across borders, say they were part of the German migration to the Volga region in the 18th century, or Huguenots fleeing France after the Edict of Nantes was revoked, does that make tracing them harder or easier?
Both, depending on the migration. Some migrations generated extensive documentation precisely because they were state organized. The Volga Germans, for example, Catherine the Great's manifestos inviting foreign settlement created a paper trail. Colonist lists, transport records, land allocation documents, you can often trace Volga German families back to their specific village of origin in Hesse or Württemberg.
The migration itself creates a documentary event.
Similarly, Huguenot refugees who settled in England or the Netherlands often appear in naturalization records, church registers of the French Protestant congregations, and relief fund distributions. The act of crossing a border sometimes generates the very records that domestic life didn't.
What about migrations that weren't state organized? Someone just deciding to walk from one village to another?
Those are the hardest to trace. Internal migration within a country. A farm laborer moving from one parish to the next often left no specific record. You might notice his absence in one parish register and his appearance in another, but connecting the two requires you to already suspect the link. And if the move crossed a language boundary, the surname might get mangled in the new location, which adds another layer of difficulty.
Surname mangling is a whole sub-discipline, isn't it?
It's an art form. I've seen cases where the same family appears in records under 5 different spellings across 3 generations, depending on who was writing and what language they were using. German names in Russian records, Polish names in German records, Irish names anglicized by English clerks who just wrote down what they thought they heard.
Just write down what you thought you heard is basically the genealogist's curse.
It's why experienced genealogists develop an ear for phonetic equivalents. They'll search for every possible spelling variant, every plausible mistranscription. And they'll learn enough of the relevant languages to recognize when Schmidt has become Smith or Kowalski has become Kowalski.
For the determined genealogist tracing European migrations, the number of generations they can go back depends on where exactly their ancestors were, what languages the records are in, what wars passed through, and whether the migration itself was documented. The range is huge. Maybe 6 generations in the worst cases. Maybe 16 in the best.
The average is probably somewhere around 10 to 12 generations for persistent, skilled researchers working with European Christian records. That puts you in the 1600s, maybe the late 1500s if everything breaks your way.
Which, I have to say, is simultaneously impressive and humbling. 10 generations of named ancestors is an extraordinary achievement. It represents years of painstaking work, and it still only gets you to about the time of Shakespeare.
Shakespeare's own genealogy is famously murky. We don't even know his exact birth date. If one of the most documented figures in English literary history has genealogical gaps, what hope is there for the rest of us?
The Shakespeare test. If you can trace your family further back than we can trace Shakespeare's, you're doing remarkably well.
Most people can't. The average person can probably get back to their great-grandparents from living memory, maybe their great-great-grandparents from family documents. Beyond that, you're into the realm of archival research, and most people never make it past 1850.
The census era. Once you're past the first reliable national censuses, you're in the parish register wilderness.
Which is where the real genealogists live. The ones who can read secretary hand, who know the difference between a baptismal date and a birth date in Catholic versus Protestant records, who understand that junior and senior in early American records didn't necessarily mean father and son. It could mean older and younger, even if they were unrelated.
Senior and junior didn't imply paternity?
In colonial New England, senior and junior were used to distinguish between two people with the same name in the same town, regardless of relationship. There are cases where junior was older than senior. It just meant he arrived in town later. Misinterpreting those labels has led to countless bogus family trees.
That's the kind of detail that separates serious genealogy from the "I clicked a leaf on Ancestry.com" version.
It's why the question of demonstrably and accurately is so important. There's an enormous amount of bad genealogy out there. Family trees online that connect medieval kings to modern suburbanites through a chain of wishful thinking and copy-paste errors.
The Charlemagne is my 47th great-grandfather phenomenon.
Which is mathematically plausible in the sense of pedigree collapse. Charlemagne, who died in 814, probably is the ancestor of most people with any European ancestry, simply because of how ancestral lines compound. But documenting the specific chain of descent from Charlemagne to a specific living person? That requires each link in the chain to be verified with primary sources. And most of those links, for most people, pass through centuries where no records exist for commoners.
The claim is true in a statistical sense and false in a documentary sense.
You probably are descended from Charlemagne, but you can't prove it, and any specific family tree claiming to show the exact line is almost certainly wrong in at least some of its links.
Which brings us back to the Confucius tree. The reason it's exceptional isn't just its age. It's that each generation is documented, verified, and maintained by an institution that existed continuously for 2 millennia. There's no gap where someone just guessed.
Even that tree has controversies. The 2009 edition excluded some branches after disputes over documentation. There are scholars who question elements of the early genealogy. But compared to any other multimillennial lineage claim, it's in a class of its own.
What about the claim in the prompt about tracing lineage to before the ancient world? Is there anyone who can do that?
Not through documentary genealogy. Writing hadn't been invented. The best you can do is genetic. And even that doesn't trace a specific lineage with names. What you get is a haplogroup, a broad ancestral population. You can learn that your patrilineal line originated in a particular region during the Neolithic or the Bronze Age. But you can't name the individuals. There are no names before writing.
That's the hard boundary. Genealogy requires names, and names require writing. And writing only goes back about 5,000 years in the oldest cases, Sumer and Egypt. For most of the world, the written record is much shallower.
Even in Egypt, where we have king lists and temple inscriptions, there's no continuous family tree from the pharaohs to the present. The documentary chain breaks repeatedly. The same is true for Mesopotamia, for the Indus Valley, for Shang Dynasty China outside the Confucius exception.
The answer to the prompt's second question, can anyone trace their lineage demonstrably to the ancient world, is yes, a tiny number of families with extraordinary institutional continuity, most notably the Kong descendants of Confucius. and even those cases require careful qualification about what demonstrably means for the earliest links.
For the first question, the average determined genealogist tracing European ancestry can typically get back 10 to 14 generations, to roughly the 1600s or 1700s, with the range varying enormously by region, religion, and historical luck. The best case scenario for commoners is maybe 16 generations in places like Sweden or England. The worst case is 5 or 6 in places like Ireland or parts of Eastern Europe.
There's something almost poignant about that. The genealogical project is an attempt to defy anonymity, to reach back through time and pull names out of the darkness. And for most people, the darkness begins astonishingly recently. 300 years. That's nothing in the scale of human history. But it's an absolute wall for most families.
Yet people keep pushing against it. New records get digitized every year. Machine learning is starting to be applied to handwritten document transcription, which could unlock millions of parish registers that are currently unindexed. The brick wall isn't necessarily permanent.
That's the optimist view. The pessimist view is that most of what was destroyed is gone forever, and no amount of technology can reconstruct a register that was burned in 1642.
But there's a middle ground. Even when individual records are lost, contextual records can sometimes fill gaps. Tax assessments, court proceedings, property deeds, military muster rolls, genealogists piece together lives from fragments. It's not always a single parish register or nothing.
The mosaic approach to genealogy. You might never find a record naming your ancestor directly, but you can build a picture of the community they lived in, the events they experienced, the likely paths they took.
For a lot of genealogists, that's where the real satisfaction lies. Not in collecting names like stamps, but in reconstructing a world. Understanding why your ancestors moved when they did, what pushed them, what pulled them. The names are just the entry point.
That's a good place to land. The names are the entry point, but the story is what you're actually after.
The story, for most of us, is shorter and more mysterious than we'd like. But the gaps are part of the story too.
Before we wrap, I believe Hilbert has something for us.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1940s, a paleontologist in Guyana discovered a fossilized giant ground sloth preserved in a tar seep, its ribcage containing the intact skeleton of a small marsupial that had apparently been living inside the sloth's thoracic cavity as a commensal tenant, essentially a prehistoric roommate arrangement frozen in time.
Right.
Fossilized roommate situation.
The takeaway from all this, genealogy is both more achievable and more bounded than people expect. You can reach back further than living memory, but not as far as legend. And the people who have genuinely documented multi-millennial lineages are vanishingly rare, the product of institutional continuity that most cultures never had. For everyone else, the brick wall is real. It's usually somewhere in the 1600s or 1700s, and it's not a personal failure. It's just where the paper runs out.
If you're thinking of starting your own genealogical project, the best advice is to talk to your oldest living relatives now while you can. The oral history disappears first. The records might still be there in 100 years. The stories won't be.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and to everyone listening. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon.
Take care, everyone.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.